Happy evening, glow of our home star, Epsilon Eridani. I'm going to tell you the story of a streetcar named Desire. This was a very important play on our planet of origin, Earth, about 430 years ago. This is a story about Blanche, a fading southern...
What is fading?
It's like losing the aspects of her flesh that make her attractive for reproduction.
Could she not engage in submolecular tissue regeneration?
Well, they didn't have that back then. Now, Blanche arrives in New Orleans, this steamy city where she has
to... Hold on, what percentage of the atmosphere New Orleans is non-aqueous xenon?
You know, I'm not sure. Earth was very different back then. Look, we can't get all bogged down in every little detail. This is a play about sex and loneliness and death, and those were enormous themes back then, and this play still has much to teach us, but not if you're going to ask a lot of scientific questions about it.
We are never lonely. Was Blanche aware of the supreme formula which allows us to harness the Higgs boson particle to destroy the illusion of human separateness?
No, this play was written in 1947. That's 81 years before humans would even understand that the Great Bieber was sent to us from another galaxy to teach us the supreme formula.
Did the Great Bieber ever perform in this play?
Well, he did do Stanley Kowalski once in Edmonton, but the reviews were not so good.
How can anything the Great Bieber did not be sublime?
Okay, that's it. If you don't want to hear the story, that's fine, but you're never going to understand the human condition. You'll just continue to be what you are, highly evolved brain tissue pods and semi-permeable acrylic casings, and you won't know about loss and desire and fear. You'll be stuck with a purely scientific belief system predicated on an otherwise forgettable Canadian pop star. Now, I'm going to go through the airlock for a few minutes, and everybody can just leave me alone!
Wow. Somebody got up on the wrong side of the sleep capsule today.
Seriously. Well, there's some kind of auditory broadcast coming on connected to what she was saying. And now his role as Stanley's brother, Morty Kowalski, was cut from the final draft, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, that's true. Tennessee Williams assured me that I would play Morty. And then the part just wasn't there when the whole thing opened. So let me tell you what we're doing and where we are. But first of all, New Haven, make some noise. Come on, let him know. We love coming here. We're in the lobby of the study, which is a wonderful place on Chapel Street. We recommend that you visit it. And if you could visit it sort of in between now and 2 p.m. today, you could join us because we're all here and you're welcome to be here too. We're here because Yale Rep is in fact doing A Streetcar Named Desire. It opens this Friday. It runs through October 12th. Get your tickets now. And let me tell you who's here in the lobby with us. Mark Rucker is the director of A Streetcar Named Desire. James Bundy is the artistic director at the Yale Rep. Renee Augustin is playing Blanche Dubois in the Yale Rep's staging of A Streetcar. And Joe Manganiello is playing Stanley Kowalski in the Yale Rep's staging of A Streetcar. You may know him from some other TV show. I'm not sure what it's called. No, we'll talk about that as we go along here. But, you know, I'd just like to begin by just... every time something is restaged in New Haven, there's about an 85% chance that the first time it was ever done was in New Haven. And that's certainly the case with Streetcar. I think it's true that the first time these lines were ever spoken from a stage, it was probably at the Schubert sometime in late 47.
That's right.
Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, Mark Rucker, maybe we can just pause for a second and just think about what the play was then. In some ways, it is kind of a landmark in a lot of ways. And in 47, I'm sure even the depiction of kind of raw sexuality was probably kind of a little bit of a trailblazer right then.
Absolutely. And the powerful acting, the vibrant script, and the Ilya Kazan's production was remarkable. And I read this wonderful piece that the playwright Arthur Miller wrote about being Kazan asking him to come up on the train from New York and take a look at this thing. And lots of people were doing it. There were whispers around New York about this thing that was being launched and what an incredible, unique, new kind of theater it was.
You know, I mean, I think about all the ways in which it sort of does, it did sort of shift the pile a little bit, you know, create, you know, like Joe Manganiello, I know you've done Stanley Kowalski before, you love this play, and in a way... Even the Tennessee Williams finding music in working class speech, mm-hmm. you know, was probably a relatively new thing. I mean, it kind of sets up David Mamet and a whole bunch of other very naturalistic working class oriented writers to come.
Yeah, and I think so. I think that, you know, obviously Marlon Brando being associated with the original production here in New Haven, and then, of course, the movie that most people have seen. You know, Marlon Brando was really credited with I think, ushering in a new era of acting, which took it away from the presentational theater style that was filmed in movies. And he really, you know, he mumbled and turned his back to the audience and did a lot of, you know, things that were considered disrespectful at the time, but it was more naturalistic. And I think that what's so amazing about Williams's writing was that it's a very it's a very big and epic play in that, you know, the turn of the 20th century, like, you know, 1900 drama was what went on in your neighbor's kitchen, you know, whereas Shakespeare in the Victorian era was more about, you know, patricide and king killing and just piles of bodies. And I think what it did was it kind of combined this heightened excitement, these epic scenes, but it was acted in a realistic fashion, much in the way that those Chekhov and Ibsen plays were. And I think the combination of that was just a very powerful thing.
Well, you know, and James Bundy, there's a way in which the theatrical styles of the two protagonists kind of represent the exact kind of collision and breaking point that he's talking about. And, you know, at least indulge me in this theory, and then you can tell me how wrong I am. But that Stanley is sort of, you know, the perfectly naturalistic character, whereas Blanche, because she's composed of a lot of mannerisms, and probably, I mean, I don't think any of us saw Jessica Tandy do it when it opened on Broadway, but because, in fact, she's composed of sort of a little bit more artifice and a little bit more pretense, it's almost like you're seeing these two theatrical traditions in collision in the form of these two characters.
Yeah, I think that's a really great observation, Colin. A lot of what you're experiencing in the story of the play is a collision of two worlds, a world that Blanche comes from back in Laurel, and a world that she arrives in New Orleans, which is a bustling post-war city in a neighborhood that is multi-ethnic and working class and not like anything she's experienced before in her life. And in addition, I think you've got a writer who, as Mark and Joe have said, is coming out of a fairly bold theatrical tradition, actually, in America, with people like Eugene O'Neill, who was also writing working class characters. But, you know, this is not far removed from Expressionism, mm-hmm. From the height of Expressionism. And so there's a theatricality to the piece that perhaps we don't appreciate as much, having seen it on film as many times as we have.
So, Renee, as you sort of make choices about Blanche, this is, you know, such a complicated character. And she has theatricality within a play that has theatricality, too. And she's maybe of the three leads, she's the one that you could sort of, I don't know, you sort of need to move her around in time somehow. I mean, do you locate Blanche in sort of the 1940s, or have you tried to make her a 2013 gal?
Oh, I don't know that I look at it in that way. You know, my responsibility to this piece is not so much to the realism as, like we've been talking about, it's to the fantasy, you know, and to the hyper-reality of it, because she's always sort of skating the line between reality and fantasy, and her way is not naturalistic, but to always sort of live beyond it.
So we're talking about A Streetcar Named Desire. As we go along here, by the way, towards the end of the show, we'll let a floating mic go out into the audience, and if the audience has questions that they want to ask, well, then they will. We will at some point talk about Wolfman, but we've got a lot of other things we have to cover before we get to Wolfman. So anyway, it's great to have everybody here at the study in New Haven. I think, just to go back to the sort of the original production just for a second, there are all these sort of amazing stories connected to it, including, I think, that Williams did not... First of all, nobody ever heard of Marlon Brando or Jessica Tandy, right? They were relatively obscure actors. I read somewhere that Brando had to borrow car fare, and he rode up to Provincetown and did a reading for Williams and then did repairs on Williams' house, right?
That's right, yeah.
Further sort of confirming his credibility as, like, a working-class Stanley. He did, like,
I believe he had done small parts in some Broadway shows, including a show with the Lunts.
Yeah. And then I also read that when the play first debuted in New York, there was at the end, there was sort of stunned silence for a moment, and then 30 minutes of applause.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, 30 minutes. I mean, that could be Broadway legend. Who knows? But you guys will get at least 20 minutes, right, of sustained applause.
We're going for 31 here.
Yeah. I want to talk also a little bit about why this play endures so much. I mean, look, you guys are doing it right now. They're doing it, I think, at the Gate in Dublin. I don't know where else they're doing it. But really, there probably aren't too many moments in the last 50 years where somebody isn't taking a substantial whack at this play. Somewhere in the English-speaking world, there's a, you know, interesting production of Streetcar going up. And so, Renee Augustin, why do we think that is? I mean, why does this play stick around? It's got to be one of the most restaged American plays, if not the most.
Well, they're iconic characters, and they're huge shoes to fill. And it's, you know, basically about, you know, two characters who are incredibly compelled and repelled by each other at the same time. And that's very scary. And I think a lot of theater people are drawn to scary things, you know, to see if they can fill the big shoes that have filled them before.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways that this can play out. And Joe Manganiello, how scary is this production? How scary is... Stanley can be super, super scary. I mean, he's been done a lot of different ways. I don't know. How scary is Stanley this time around? How violent is he, too?
He's scary and violent. I mean, that's just written into the play, no matter who plays him.
Yeah.
You know, our stage combat expert Rick Nasita looked at me and said, "I've never seen a Stanley that big." So, you know, we'll see how that translates. You know, I was told to me once that, you know, a woman rips a TV off the wall and smashes it on the ground, she gets a pass. A man rips the TV off the wall and smashes it on the ground, he's wrong. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's such an interesting play in that, you know, you have these people that have these obstacles, handicaps, whatever you want to call them, that are completely untreated, and their instincts are in collision repeatedly over the course of this play. And, you know, this is 1947, so, you know, a lot of the self-help that's available to people now to treat these types of things was not readily available for these people. So you have them stuck in these two tiny rooms just going at it, and it's fascinating to watch.
I always think about that, you know, with so much great drama, yeah, now they get into counseling, Blanche would go on Lexapro.
Yeah. Stella's at Al-Anon, and, you know, yeah, sure.
Just, you know, I mean... You know, Othello and Desdemona, they get into counseling, you know, they would have figured this whole thing out. That's why we're so glad there was no therapeutic model.
Yeah, if people properly communicated, there would be no theater.
You know, I mean, I don't mean to overemphasize this, but actually just running into you here at this lobby of the study, you're one big werewolf / Stanley. And I in some ways, I mean, is that, I don't know, do you have to play against that at all? I mean, you're the size of an NFL linebacker. I didn't really actually realize that until I met you here today.
That is true, yes. Yeah, somewhere my father is shaking his fist at the fact that I'm not playing in the NFL right now. But, you know, no, I think it helps. You know, in terms of playing a Wolfman, you know, I think the tenderness of him is completely juxtaposed or amazingly juxtaposed by the size and violence that you know, that I can bring because of how big I am. And I think that, you know, in terms of Stanley, that is also the case. I think there are moments in the play where you really see how much Stanley loves his wife. Mm-hmm. He really loves her, and that's really the fight. I think he's really fighting for that in this crazy way. He just has these severe handicaps that get in the way of him expressing that properly.
We're talking about A Streetcar Named Desire. We're here in the study in New Haven on Chapel Street. If you're listening here in the afternoon, you could actually come and join our live audience here. They shouldn't be here. I mean, not the audience, but the people doing this. They're opening on Friday. They don't really have an hour to sit here and do a radio interview. But they're doing it anyway, and that's great. That they're opening at the Yale Rep on Friday in this. You know, the other thing that that's interesting, James Bundy, is the way that this play is, in our minds, kind of no longer contained even within the play. I mean, there are so many riffs on this play everywhere, ranging from, The Simpsons famously did a musical, A Streetcar Named Marge, I think is the episode, and Kurt Vonnegut's short story, Who Am I This Time? It's all about the staging of a streetcar in a little theater in Barnstable, Massachusetts. Woody Allen, and maybe we'll get to that in just a second. His new movie, Blue Jasmine, is basically kind of a retelling of Streetcar. And there's a way in which this play, it's hard to think of another play that is like this, that its tropes, you know, are there's a contest in New Orleans where people just walk around yelling Stella and staring their T-shirts.
Yeah, I think people have been asking Joe to yell Stella, you know, since he's been in town. I think we do, you know, there's a desire to make these great, complicated masterworks familiar and sort of turn them into the kind of soundbite that, you know, we can say, oh, we know what that is, or... And so it's the depth of the piece that invites endless riffing, and then of course you go to see it and you have a fundamentally different experience when you're actually in the theater and you're hearing music, because you know people don't often think of the musical landscape of the play, but that's a wonderful part of the whole experience of being in the theater.
It's a great point that it starts to become kind of inert if just the little riffs and tropes and stuff like that sort of turn up in other settings, and you forget the power of it. Is that, I mean, obviously, this play gets staged a lot, and it was done in Michael Wilson's time up at Hartford Stage with Estella and Stanley, who fell in love and got married, as I recall. I mean, not on stage, but the two actors did. Why did Yale Rep decide to do this right now? I mean, what was the...
Well, so, you know, for us to, it's the first time in the history of Yale Rep that we've produced the play. Mm-hmm. It's a masterwork. We've actually been talking to Mark and to Renee for several years about the possibility of their coming here to do it, because it's not the kind of play that you would go after if you didn't have artists who were really passionate about doing it. Mm-hmm. and who wanted to be at the center of it. And so we put it in the schedule, and then we got very lucky that Joe was actually looking for a play by Tennessee Williams to do, and lo and behold, we had one. So it's been a very happy ride.
And Renee, why were you passionate? Why were they talking to you in particular? Why were you passionate about doing Blanche?
Well, Mark and I have worked together several times, and James and I have worked together several times, and I haven't done much Williams, and I think this is maybe the hardest part, female part, maybe one of the hardest parts that... female parts that Williams has, and as I said before, I really like to be scared by what I'm doing, and you know, she just walks this tightrope through the entire production that at any given moment she could fall off of. Mm-hmm. and tries to relate to people on her level and very rarely gets them to relate to her on that level, and it was very compelling to me, and I wanted to see, you know, if I could give it a go.
You know, just sort of back to that idea, though, of it sort of the play being out in the culture. I mean, I think another reason that the play is out in the culture, I mean, I don't know how many of you have seen, for example, the Simpsons episode, but in the Simpsons episode, one of the things that happens is that Marge starts to realize that Homer kind of is Stanley in certain ways, and she starts to take stock of her marriage because of this. And in the Vonnegut story, you know, it's about these two, this guy in particular who's sort of psychologically and emotionally impaired, the only way that he can find himself is being in the theater performances of this little tiny theater in his town, and he plays all these great roles, and he plays Stanley, and they find somebody to do Stella with him, and the two of them just ignite on stage, and then when they're not on stage, he just goes off to his job at the hardware store and turns back into this very bland guy, and she's trying to reach out to him, and she can't find him because he's not there. But, you know, in both of those instances, and I'm sure we could come up with dozens of other Mark Rucker, others, what we see is people finding themselves somewhere in this play or finding their lives somewhere in this play. Joe's nodding right now, but I'm going to have you answer first, and then I'll go over to Joe.
Well, for me, right now at least, it's a lot about survival. Mm. I see people trying to survive in the world, and, you know, maybe it's forging a new life, maybe it's trying to hang on to an existing life, but it's very raw and scary.
Yeah. Joe, you were nodding, as I said, by talking about just sort of finding your own life, finding somebody else.
No, I was agreeing with what you're saying. I think that's why I love the play so much, is that, you know, you know these characters, you know these people. And you know, I was talking about it a couple weeks ago, and that, you know, Breaking Bad is coming to an end. And, you know, the idea of this anti-hero as hero, whether it's, you know, Tony Soprano or, you know, Don Draper, you know, there's an idea that that this anti-hero is new. It's something new, but this play was written in 1947, and it is this, to me, it's this classic, you know, it is the quintessential anti-hero. There are people that side with Stanley, and on a given night, you might side with Blanche, you might side with Stella. You know, you have to understand why this woman would stay with that man. And I think aside from that, you know, people see themselves in it. The, you know, the character of Mitch, the nice guy who finishes last, mm-hmm. and this terrible guy who gets the world. Mm-hmm. And you have, you know, the aging beauty. I think that's such an interesting thing as well. You know, I think it's very easy. He was such a great writer, and I think that the emotion in it is so true. No matter how many layers of poetry is on top of it, the emotion is really true. And I think that anybody would come and see this and see themselves in one of those characters, at least somewhat, to some percentage.
Yeah, I mean, I want to stay with the anti-hero idea for just a second here, too. And I mean, when you mentioned that, I think, or you might have mentioned it in a different interview, too, but in connection with Walter White on Breaking Bad. But really, I hadn't thought about it, but Tony Soprano and Stanley, I mean, there's an umbilical cord connecting those two dudes.
There's a lot of similarity. Yeah. Yeah.
Even that kind of sense of sort of finding it, you've got this sort of big, powerful, frequently violent strain of masculinity, mm-hmm. but trying to find some other tools too. You know, I mean, Stanley through the play is looking for maybe some other set of tools to deal with the situation besides just his own eruptions.
Yeah, well, you know, he and Stella have a dance. They have this dance, and it was working somehow. Like, they were both willing participants in this crazy dance until you enter in another factor, yeah. you know, which is Blanche, and in his mind throws everything off.
I feel like Blanche is, you know, just back to the notion, we're going to take a break in just a second here, but I feel like Blanche is, in some ways, the character that I feel I most recognize in the world around me. In some ways, she's this impossibly layered, weird, freaky person who couldn't possibly exist, except that I know five or six people.
Right.
I mean, you know, did you find that just drawing on the characterization, too? Don't say who it is you in your life that you're modeling Blanche on, because this will turn into a podcast, and they'll find it.
Seriously.
And they'll never speak
to
you
again. It
would
be a bad thing.
Yeah.
No, it is true that she sees truths that other people deny. Mm. You know, she sees truths about herself and takes steps in order so that other people don't see them. She sees truths about her sister's marriage. She sees truths all around her that other people are just, you know, either choosing to ignore or don't see. Mm. And it's a very, very, very frustrating thing. I've experienced that in my own life. So, you know, yeah.
But I think more than that, too. I mean, there's some things that don't change. I mean, this play was written in 1947, but the notion of a woman coping with sort of changes in her allure, you know, for all that we purport to have evolved, the dilemma that she's in there, you know, that somehow or other she needs a different kind of lighting.
Well, they didn't have plastic surgery or Botox right. back then. So, you know, I mean, putting a paper lantern over the light was the next best thing.
Yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit more about this. But first of all, I want to tell you that we're here in the lobby of the study in New Haven on Chapel Street. We have a wonderful audience here. Audience, prove you exist. We'll take a little break. We'll be back with more. All right, don't you wish you were here at the study in New Haven? Show them how happy you are, people in the study. We're on Chapel Street in New Haven. We're with the cast and team behind A Streetcar Named Desire, which is opening Friday night, whether anybody's ready for it or not, at the Yale Rep. You know, Mark Rucker, Mark Rucker's the director. One thing we didn't sort of talk about at the beginning, there are many, many things that have coalesced to make this show so iconic. But one of them is one of the greatest freaking titles ever, mm-hmm. and he originally wanted to call it like The Moth and Blanche's Chair on
Poker
the Moon.
Night.
Yeah,
Poker
like
night.
Had all these really bad ideas. I mean, am I wrong? Is it not also just a title that, you know, that says so much too?
Yep. Yes.
And apparently based on it, when he was there, there was a streetcar named Desire. Yes. I think another one called Cemetery.
Yes.
And he felt like
but
he
you
was...
actually couldn't take one to the other. And that was a very useful thing for me in getting ready for the production, to understand how he used New Orleans and used the incredible... I mean, the geography of New Orleans is amazing, and the names of streets and parks and things, it's fantastic. And so he chose the ones that he loved and put them together to create this destination that you actually couldn't get to the way she describes. Mm-hmm. So there's reality there, and there's permission there.
You know, the other thing that struck me as we were getting ready for the show, too, is I was trying to think of another movie based on a great American drama that has become what this movie is. And you know, there really isn't a fabulous... There are movies of Arthur R. Miller. There are movies based on Eugene O'Neill. There are other Tennessee Williams movies. There's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, an Edward Albee movie. That might be the closest thing to...
It probably is the closest, yeah.
Yeah, and that's... But it's interesting that way, and maybe a thing that we've lost, too, that a play that was as significant as this was in the late 1940s then became a movie that, like, everybody saw.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, so you named, I think, probably the, you know, Long Day's Journey, Death of a Salesman, this play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Those are sort of on everybody's list of the four greatest American plays, and a lot of people might argue that Angels in America is the fifth, and that took about 10 years to make it to HBO. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and a lot more hours to spend. But and this is, you know, in terms of, Renee, in terms of sort of doing classical American theater, this is one of the times, one of the rare times, when you're running into people's memories, cinematic memories of a role. That there's, first of all, did you just stay away from the movie as much as possible? Yes.
I did. I actually have never seen the movie all the way through. I have seen clips and stuff like that. And you know, when I'm doing something that has been made into a movie, I try to stay away from it because I don't want any, you know, I'm afraid I'll steal something that's that someone will recognize, and how horrifying is that? Yeah. But it, you know, you of course are going to be compared to all the others who have played it, but you can't keep that in your mind, and you can't, you know, you can't have that over your shoulder because it would just make you crazy.
Totally. But on the other hand, they're kind of just in the ways that there are all kinds of tropes, ranging from yelling Stella to, you know, all kinds of things that are sort of out there in the culture. They're kind of aren't from Long Day's Journey Into Night. They're kind of aren't from a lot of the sort of from Death of a Salesman. There are maybe people know a couple of lines from Death of a Salesman, but because of the movie, these things sort of get out there. What about you, Joe? Did you just sort of avoid thinking about Brando watching the movie, or?
Yeah, I mean, I saw the movie in high school when I first, you know, really started getting serious about acting. And, you know, I performed the play in, you know, 5 years ago in West Virginia. And I watched it kind of like, you know, once I got done with my run, I sat down and watched it and was in shock at how different my take was than Brando's, let's say, and how different the movie is from the play.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel it's different?
I think the one thing that people don't realize is how funny Stanley is. There are a lot of moments that are very funny, and Tennessee Williams writes in threes a lot, and three is kind of the magical comedy number. Mm-hmm. And it appears a lot. He does things three times in a row, you know, I think in my personal opinion, I think that, you know, Brando was rebelling against an entire acting style at the time that he performed it. And I think that there was some energy put into that rebellion against the presentational style. And, you know, I don't have to rebel against anything. I just have to do the play. And, you know, but I think the first time I performed this was 16 years ago, so I feel like it's mine as much as it's anybody else's, so I don't really feel any need to, you know, kowtow to anybody.
Hey, have any of the four of you seen Blue Jasmine yet?
No.
No? Well, then we can't have a conversation about it. Although I just would observe, and I think this goes back to something that you said, Mark, before, if I understood what you were saying, Woody Allen It's not explicitly or exactly a streetcar, but it is streetcar in a lot of ways. And one of the triggers for the Blanche equivalent's fall in this is that she's married to Alec Baldwin, a former Stanley Kowalski, as we know. But she's married to Alec Baldwin. He's not the Stanley of this movie. He's really the guy she got married to, who eventually died, and he's also like a hedge fund guy, and he's lost all of his money. I mean, in a Justice Department investigation, she's down at the heels now. She's got all kinds of financial problems. But it reminds me of something that you said earlier, which is like, I think when you see the play or the movie, and I don't know what the staging is going to be like at Yale Rep, but you're just aware of the kind of economic claustrophobia too. There's like a claustrophobia, like they're in this apartment, but they're also, nobody's doing all that well. And Blanche is sort of the symbol of a lost fortune too, which is very 2008 to 2013.
Yeah, I mean, this great, I don't know how great it was, Belle Reve, their estate, their plantation, but she describes it as slowly over the years being sold off parcel by parcel until there was just the home left, and everybody died off except for her. And so this ill-equipped woman lands with all the responsibility for this thing that was foisted on her by her forefathers.
And because of their epic fornications.
That's correct.
The four-letter word.
So, you know, it's a tough situation that she had. Mm-hmm. It's completely traumatic. That all of the death and all of the loss that she comes from triggers some behaviors in her that I get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now.
And lands her with nothing. And she's lost her job, and there's a mysterious couple of weeks before she lands in New Orleans, where we don't know, well, maybe you do, but I don't, what happened to her. And she's stuck in a completely foreign environment in these two rooms with just a curtain between them, these three people having to live together. It's difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and today, Belle Reve would have wound up in some collateralized derivative Wall Street instrument and would have wiped out all of our 401ks. But it's still a very familiar thing right now, I think, anyway. Somebody who doesn't have what they used to and isn't even really necessarily prepared to live this new reality. There is kind of a freshness to it that way.
Yeah, so, well, there's also, I think, the kind of the eradication of the Southern way as they knew it. I mean, I don't know if I think about Gone with the Wind a lot, reading this play. It's almost like in kind of this evil sequel to Gone with the Wind, I mean...
No, the evil sequel to Gone with the Wind is True Blood, actually.
Yeah, right.
That's what's happened to Louisiana.
Which Tennessee Williams would have loved. Yeah, he would have loved True Blood.
Louisiana is now overrun with vampires and werewolves. That's what's happened since Blanche. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, go ahead with what you're saying.
No, and I think that, in a lot of ways, Stanley is meant to be this almost this wrecking ball to the South. I mean, in a way of that way of life,
Oh yeah, I mean, he's certainly not Blanche's idea of what a Southern man is supposed to be.
He's the opposite. Yeah,
the opposite. Yeah. All right, we're gonna take a quick break here. Well, no, before we take a break, I want to get to one more thing because it kind of fits in with where we are right now, and I just want to make sure we don't skate past it too. It seems to me that one of the things that happens in stagings of this is that choices have to be made to a certain degree about kind of how the sort of Blanche-Stanley seesaw is going to tip, and where, I mean, there's subtle adjustments in sympathies, I think, that can be made by the director, by the cast. If you guys had to guess about how the audiences are going to react, where their sympathies are going to lie, I mean, one possibility is it could change from night to night, that some nights the audience walks out on Blanche's side, the next night on Stanley's side. But I mean, as you sort of see this play unfolding, Renee, and you may have a very poor perspective on it since you're inhabiting Blanche's world, but how do you see this particular production sort of, speaking to sympathies?
That's a really very hard question to answer because, I am living in it, and what happens to me in it is horrific.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only look at it from my perspective. So, of course, my hope is that the audience walks out with as horrified as I am to what happens to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, as Joe has said and as you have said, on any given night, that could change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know. Yeah. I can't answer that right. question.
You asked to be seated as far from Joe as possible.
I did,
anyway,
yes,
so
I did.
Well, I'm actually not the furthest away that I could be.
I'm terrified of him.
Yeah. He's been edging closer with every... you know, well, James Bunny, maybe you do have a perspective on it. You're standing at the back of the rehearsal room sometimes. How does this one feel to you? How do you think audiences will process this?
Well, it turns out there's actually now some data about how audiences process information. And
we don't want that. That's so mechanistic.
No,
that's
no,
like,
no.
But it's like putting Blanche on Lexapro.
No, but actually, but I think there are, because I think, that, you know, because it's really about I think it's possible for audiences to identify with characters who are in conflict. In other words, characters, you know, you can really identify with each of them. Mm. You may actually, as an audience member, arrive at the same moral judgment that other people arrive at. Mm. So, for instance, if there's a rape in a play, everybody in the audience may decide that the rape is wrong, mm. right? But that doesn't mean that you don't have empathy for the person who committed the rape.
Mm.
So...
So big data on Tennessee Williams. That's disturbing. We probably know which kind of coffee they like, too.
What I mean is it turns out that plays do have moral centers to them.
Yeah.
And audiences actually do share in the morality. And a lot of what we're doing, I think, in plays, it's you know, the other reason that plays continue to grip people in a world where we could all go to therapy, right, mm-hmm. is that there are unknowable things about being human that we identify with, mm-hmm. and that sort of spiky human nature piece of what we do in the theater is why you go to see a play which has a moral problem in it, which we all understand and maybe have already made up our minds about.
And see, the truth is that these two characters, especially Stanley and Blanche, are deeply, deeply flawed, both of them. So,
and as he's saying this, I'm thinking, well, I think a lot of people would say Streetcar is a play without an obvious moral center, that's part of the mystery of the play, is where is its moral center?
Well, I think, you know, and I actually read an interview with Williams where he was talking about taking events and characters that, you know, on paper... Mm. You would easily judge them. Mm-hmm. But what he wanted to do was take you inside of that house and show you how complex and layered it actually is. And I think that that's why the play has endured, is that it is so confusing emotionally. And I think it is so complex. And I think that from moment to moment, audience members will swing back and forth between who they empathize with until the final event, which then kind of, you know, you walk out and you go out in the lobby, or you go out to dinner afterwards and you have a conversation about it. And I think that's what's so amazing.
If there is a moral center, it would probably be Stella and Mitch, mm-hmm. you know.
Closer to the moral center. Well, I mean...
But even they become completely tarnished at points. So, yeah. I mean, no one's hands are clean in this play.
Mark Rucker, to a certain degree, I don't think it's too much of a mystery where Tennessee Williams is investing most of himself. His brother actually said, oh, he is Blanche.
I think it's more complicated than that. I mean, I think that he is Blanche, of course, but I think he's in all four of the main characters to me. Unlucky in love and deeply attracted to and repelled by something brutal. Mm-hmm. So it's... I mean, going back to the idea, the who do you sympathize with,
yeah.
I think it's our job just to serve every moment mm-hmm. and not to try to load the deck or shift the play, just do the play as it's written.
Although, I mean, there directors do sometimes make pretty, like my understanding, just reading the reviews of the show that's in Ireland right now at the gate, is that they've dialed down Stanley's violence quite a bit. You know, I don't know how much, as Joe says, it's there on the page, I don't know how much you can really do that, but they... It sounded like anyway they had their thumb on the scale a little bit on Stanley's behalf. All right, we're going to take a break here in just a second. When we come back, We're going to, Joe just said we don't. Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about some other stuff. One of our four guests is a werewolf. So take out a pencil and paper and write down your guess as to which one is the werewolf. We'll be talking about other stuff when we come back.
I got a half decaf macchiato here for Stella. Stella, your coffee's ready. Stella! Did somebody write Stella on a Starbucks cup just to make me yell it? That's the third time this week. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help at the mothership from Gina Matruda and Katie Talarski. Our interns are Garrett Connolly and Albert Gordon. The part of Bill Curry was played by Carl Malden. On tomorrow's show, does the media dump gas on the fire of racial tension? And now, back to Colin.
After writing that whole thing about Stella on the Starbucks coffee cup, I was just over at JoJo's before, which is sort of down the street here, before our show today, and that apparently they have some kind of tea that's called White Monkey. And so they were going, White Monkey! Who had the White Monkey? Which sounded very Tennessee Williams-like. There's probably a Tennessee Williams unproduced play called, you know, Who Had the White Monkey or something.
A Night at the White Monkey.
Night at the White Monkey, exactly. So we're here at the study. We're here with the actors and people behind the production of Streetcar Named Desire, which is up on Friday at Yale Rep. We do have some questions coming up from the audience here, but before that, I just want to make sure I do get to a few things. Okay, so we've managed sort of to get through this entire time without really doing much more than a passing mention of True Blood. But Joe Manganiello is, of course, a werewolf on True Blood, and he is a cult figure in that way. First of all, go to James Bundy from the Yale Rep for a second. Is there a new audience that's going to be coming to the Yale Rep that hasn't gone to the shows before?
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. But you don't know yet. You're not like getting ticket orders from Louisiana and things like that.
We've had emails from Greece, people wanting to come to the show.
Yeah, and so Joe, just kind of give us a sense. What's that like for you? Obviously, you're an actor. You want to work. You want to be doing all kinds of stuff. But right now, you really are. You've got two iconic roles. You've got Stanley Kowalski, and you've got this other role that you know people really are pretty fussed up about.
Well, it's great. I mean, you know, I've been acting for 20 years, so you know, I've been playing a werewolf for. Four, five. You know, I started in theater. I started in classical theater. That's all I did for years. So, you know, what's amazing is that this crazy cult show about werewolves and vampires provided me with the opportunity to come to Yale and do this amazing production with these amazing actors and these amazing crew members and amazing support group and directors and. So, in that way, it's, you know, it's pretty incredible. You know, Mark jokingly said, I think on the first day of rehearsal, he said, I'm going to put a sign in the lobby that says any shirtlessness in this play was written by Tennessee Williams, not directed by me. So,
there should be an all werewolf Streetcar done at some point, but that is not what this one is.
Well, that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Oh, you guys are all werewolves.
He says we're not.
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen it yet, so who can say?
Blanche is a vampire, Stanley's a werewolf, they hate each other. You know?
Not to pry into the business dealings of this production, but imagine that one of the big producers in New York wants to grab this thing and bring it to Broadway. First of all, can you do that? Would True Blood, would your schedule allow that?
I go back to work on True Blood in January, which is why I haven't been able to do a play in the past 4 years. Mm. You know, the show has been amazing in that it's provided all of these unbelievable opportunities that I have been able to do like 2% of. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just the way that Yale Rep's schedule fit my schedule, it was perfect because, like I said, I haven't been able to do a play for 4 years. So
yeah.
A Broadway run of anything has been completely impossible to do with my schedule, as well as, you know, lots of movies and things.
So does that either Jim or Mark, what does that mean no Broadway run for this or?
It seems
Joe goes back to work in January.
Yeah. Well, shooting schedules can be juggled and stuff like that.
They
right?
can't.
They can't
change anything all right, okay. for anyone.
All right. Thought I'd ask anyway. Yeah. Anyway, I hate to pry, but people want to know. Let's go out to the audience here. I think just for a change of pace, somebody named Colin is going to ask a question.
Thanks, Colin.
Yeah.
Speaking of vampires and werewolves, Joe, it was, I think when I saw that you were going to be in this, my first thought was, wow, what a huge departure from True Blood, and I really hadn't known your work before True Blood. But as you all said, you know, there are things about Stanley's character that endure across time and across media and across characters, really. Mm-hmm. So I was just, you know, I was going to ask sort of the obvious question, like how much of, you know, Elsie did you channel into Stanley, and do you see any of Sookie and Blanche?
Well, I think Alcide is more Mitch. I think he's more of a Mitch. He is this nice southern gentleman who is in juxtaposition to these kind of violent, crazy, dual-natured vampires. So I think, if anything, you know, Alcide's the nice guy. You know, Stanley's completely different. He's from the north. He's, you know, Alcide's from Mississippi. Stanley, you know, Stanley's from the north. He's ill-mannered, ill-spoken. You know, it's a completely different thing. It's apples and oranges, you know. But funny, you know, I played Stanley for the first time 16 years ago, and then I played him again 5 years ago. So Stanley's a character that's been with me since I started acting, and this play's followed me since I started acting, and it's, you know, Alcide is somebody that's been relatively new to me. You know, when I cut my hair and shaved my face, people went, oh, how's the new look? And I went, well, I looked this way my whole life. You know, Alcide was a very small chapter in my career. It just happens to be the one that really, you know, popped me out and got me recognized. So.
If anybody else has a question, stick your hand up and we'll get a microphone over to you. We'll probably have time for maybe one more person. This person kind of back there. Well, while we're getting the mic to her, you've already revealed that you never watched Streetcar Named Desire, the movie, all the way through. Have you ever seen an episode of True Blood? I'm talking to Renee. Renee Augustin sounds like the name of a character on
really?
True Blood. Well, I mean, like it could be.
Oh.
Yeah. It wouldn't be
Renee Lenier was in season one. Yeah.
I have seen True Blood. I've not seen all of it. I've not seen every season, but I've seen, I think, like 3 seasons. And, of course, I will watch the rest now because I know someone in it.
You know how scary he really is.
Yeah.
All right, we've got a quick question over there. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is your third time playing Stanley, and I'm wondering how you have evolved.
Or devolved.
Or devolved as Stanley.
I hope I've evolved. Yeah, well, it's been interesting each time. You know, the first time I played, I was 20 years old, and I was, you know, a hope-to-die drinker. And I was very similar to Stanley in many ways. In fact, when I was 20 years old, I went home as the character, and I think the violence and the rage was something that I couldn't get away from. And I think that the play was very therapeutic and understandable to me in this instinctive way, where I think now 16 years later, and I'm, you know, 11 years sober, it goes from instinctively knowing how to drive the car to I can actually tell you every piece of the engine, how to take it apart, clean it, put it back together. Like, I think there's more of an understanding now, and I think I don't have to go home as him anymore, which is a real relief. I can leave it in the theater, but still open the door to that kind of dark period and pull pieces out of it, which, you know, is incredibly useful, but I don't know.
Good answer.
Yeah.
We're going to have to sort of leave it there. First of all, I want to thank Mark and James and Jero and Renee for joining us here at the study. We've got about a minute left here. I also just want to quickly say, go see live theater in Connecticut this fall. It's going to be a great fall. It's Streetcar is here. Hartford Stage is doing 2 plays in a repertory format, which like almost nobody ever does anymore, but same cast, 2 different plays. Goodspeed has Most Happy Fella. I'm not sure what Long Wharf has right now, but go see live theater. It's really good for you. I also want to just thank my crew who came down here and set up this thing, and they're always amazing. So Patrick Scahill, Kion Wolf, Betsy Kaplan, the secret weapon of NPR, is back here. How about a big hand from the audience for the NPR crew, our interns also as well, Garrett and Albert. And we'll be back tomorrow with a whole different show.
I'm Kion Wolf. Stanley! Stanley!
What?
Can you put the wet clothes in the dryer? I think it's done.
Okay.
Thanks, hon.